On May 9, 2025, Peter M. Sandman gave the 62-minute Grand Rounds presentation via Zoom with the long title, Earned Mistrust, How Public Health Forfeited Trust During COVID and Got Away With It Long Before COVID, and What It Would Take to Earn Trust Back. His sponsor was the Department of Environmental Health and Engineering of the Bloomberg School of Public Health, Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Sandman made his case that public health agencies and experts often tell noble lies, misleading the public for its own good. He had long predicted that this would eventually backfire, and during the COVID pandemic, he argued, it finally did. Before getting into some COVID examples of public health dishonesty, he focused on two prior case studies, the oral polio vaccine and measles.
All right, everyone. It is 12 o'clock, and I'm Tara Kirksell, if you don't know me. I'm stepping in today for Gigi, who the last I heard from, I got a iPhone video of some white smoke coming from Rome. So she is on the road today, and I am have the absolute pleasure of introducing you to Dr. Peter M. Sandman, who is the creator of the Risk Equals Hazard Plus Outrage formula for risk communication, and is one of the world's preeminent risk communication speakers and consultants. He's best known for his unique and effective approach to calming unduly upset stakeholders in low hazard, high outrage risk controversies. But he also has worked on how to convince apathetic people to take precautions like wearing seatbelts in high hazard, low outrage situations, and on how to guide appropriately upset people through high hazard, high outrage situations like pandemics. A Rutgers University professor from 1977 to 1995, Dr. Sandman received his PhD in communication from my alma mater, Stanford University, in 1971. He came out of near retirement when COVID struck in early 2020, and I was thankful for his great comments on how to navigate that crisis. And now he's nearly retired again, and he lives aboard a world traveling ship. So his work lives on mostly through his former clients and through his website, www.psandman.com. So, you know, Peter is one of my great heroes, and I think it's such an honor to get to introduce him and hear his words today. Please make sure that you turn off your video and mute your microphones. I am recording this, and then the students and other interested folks who are encouraged to stay on the line afterward for a small group session. So with that, Peter, please take it away.
Okay, thank you. Tara, you're running the slides, and let's move right away to the first substantive slide. There we go. As the first bullet points out, I have more slides than I have time, so I will skip some of the slides as necessary, and try and save, you know, at least a little time in the hour, not to mention the time after the hour for those of you who can stay for Q&A. Despite my title, I'm going to focus not just on dishonesty issues that came out of COVID, but also dishonesty issues that preceded COVID. My usual frame in talking about this issue is that mainstream public health is in charge of public health. It isn't as honest as I think it needs to be. As a result of its dishonesty, it loses trust and it risks losing ever more trust, and it needs to reform. That frame may not be the right frame anymore, given that it's not so clear that public health is entirely in trust. In charge. There's been something like a hostile takeover of much of public health. And the issue today, I think, is not so much how should you use your power, but how should you diagnose your loss of power? What is it that happened to you? Are you reaping, or to what extent are you reaping what you sowed? And of course, starting to figure out the path back. So I think we're on a little bit different frame than, I've spent 30, maybe 40 years consulting with various public health agencies. And the frame was always, you need to be more honest Or someday you may lose trust and may not be in charge anymore. And now someday it seems to me has come. Okay, next frame, next slide, please, sir. Okay, trust clearly declined during COVID. Trust in public health declined during COVID. The people monitoring that best, I think, are KFF. If you look at their data prior to the Trump becoming president again, you see that the decline in trust was substantial and was almost entirely on the right. So that if you look at a specific question like trust that CDC is providing accurate and usable information about COVID vaccines, just one of the questions that KFF tracks, the opinion among Democrats moved from 88% to 89%, essentially no change at all. Whereas opinion among Republicans, a belief that they could trust CDC on the COVID vaccine declined from 57% to 41%. So it was lower than for Democrats, and it got lower still during the course of the pandemic. It may not surprise you that more recent data that I don't have on the slides, also from KFF, shows that there is a new phenomenon happening. Trust has in CDC and FDA and public health generally has increased among Republicans, and it has decreased among Democrats. The Democratic support went from 88% to 89% during the pandemic. It's now down to 70%, so a significant decline. For Republicans, it went from 57% to 41%. It's now up to 51%. Just slightly over half of Republicans now think they can trust CDC on COVID vaccine information. You might think that that's a narrowing of the gap, a decline in polarization. But of course, it isn't. It's a direct result of the hostile takeover of public health agencies by people whose approach to public health is different from the approach of the public health mainstream. And as a result of that, trust by Democrats, Democrats continue to trust the public health mainstream, but they don't have nearly so much trust in the new leadership, whereas Republicans continue to distrust the mainstream, but they're more willing to trust the agencies now that the agencies are under new leadership. So this is not, it seems to me, evidence of a reduction in polarization. It's evidence of the fact that the question, do you trust the agencies, is now two questions that are pointing in very different directions. Do you trust mainstream public health versus do you trust the new management, which itself doesn't trust mainstream public health? Next slide, please. So the question is, why did trust decline? And the answer to that question that public health people invariably offer is trust has declined because people are listening to our critics. And I think that gets the causality exactly backwards. I think the truth is, for the most part, obviously both things are happening, but for the most part, the truth is that people are listening to your critics because they don't trust you. Or more to the point, in some ways, people have started listening more to your critics because they have learned to trust you less. And this suggests that rather than focusing on trust, public health maybe needs to pay more attention to trustworthiness. And I don't want to overstate the case. It is certainly true that public health has lots of critics. It is certainly true that people are listening to those critics. It's true that some of those critics are bad faith grifters who are peddling horribly dangerous misinformation. It's also true that some of those critics are good faith critics. And even the good faith critics may overstate public health mistakes, perhaps treating mistakes as if they were lies. And some of you may think I am treating mistakes as if they were lies, and I will try not to do that. But the point is, yes, you have opponents, you have enemies, and yes, it's true that people are listening to them. But trust was yours to lose, and your opponents were outliers until and had much smaller audiences until you forfeited trust, until public health forfeited trust, particularly during COVID, but also in running up to COVID. And that forfeit in trust led to people listening to the outliers. I mean, I think it's crucially important to understand that the mainstream starts with all the advantages. You have the budget, you have the credibility, you have the media access, you have the authoritarian power, you were in charge, you have the institutional legitimacy. Outliers did not stand a chance to wrest trust away from public health. Public health had to forfeit it, and then outliers could seize it. People who began to wonder whether they could trust public health began to look around for other people that they might listen to instead. Okay, next slide, please. Now, I want to very, very briefly go to what I consider to be the big picture. As Tara pointed out, the slogan that paid my children's way through college was risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. That is, risk is a function of both how endangered we are and how upset we are. And what's important in that relationship is that outrage is a very good, very powerful cause of hazard perception. That is, how endangered we think we are is largely a function of how upset we are. And it should come as no surprise that untrustworthiness or distrust is a major source of outrage. It's upsetting to be lied to or to be misled or to be told half-truths or to think that that's what's happening. Next slide, please. The causal structure here, and this is the model I offered my corporate clients working with distrust of the oil industry or the chemical industry or the forest products industry, all the companies that I worked with as well as public health for decades. And what I said is, okay, you're misleading your stakeholders. You are also, and I'm not going to deal with this today, you are also being contemptuous of your stakeholders. The result of that is they get upset. They don't like being treated the way you treat them. That damages your reputation, it increases mistrust, but importantly, it also changes their perception of the substance of the hazard. When you are not trusted, when they feel like you are lying to them, they wind up thinking that their opinion of the substance of what you're talking about goes in the opposite direction from where you want it to go and where you're trying to get it to go. So, for example, I mean, in decades of working with companies, the paradigm for me was, let's say you are the plant manager of a factory and your neighbors think your factory is giving them cancer. And the evidence says your factory is not giving them cancer. Your emissions are relatively benign. The regulators are not worried about your emissions. But your neighbors are horribly worried about your emissions. And the reason my analysis was with clients, the main reason why they don't trust your data that say you're not giving them cancer is because you're acting like a jerk. You're being contemptuous. You're being dishonest. You're not answering their emails. You're acting like a jerk. And if you stop acting like a jerk, they'll stop imagining that your emissions are giving them cancer. Maybe the way to put it is, if you stop acting like a jerk, they'll stop listening so much to the activists who are claiming your emissions are giving them cancer. And this is what I had to say to clients and trying to persuade clients whose emissions were in fact benign. I tried not to work with clients who, if they were giving their neighbors cancer. But if you're not giving your neighbors cancer, I would say if you become more trustworthy, they will find it easier to think that your emissions are benign. Now, the question is the same thing true of vaccines? As of factory emissions, that is, if you stop acting like a jerk, people will stop thinking your vaccines are dangerous, and other issues that where public health has come to be mistrusted. Next slide, please. Now, it ought to be the same for public health as for corporations. That is the dominant causal structure ought to be dishonesty leads to outrage. Outrage leads to reduced acceptance of your hazard assessments, reduced acceptance of your precautionary recommendations. But it doesn't always work out that way, or hasn't always worked out that way. And the main reason is the first point in the but part of the slide. And that is that public health dishonesty is both less likely to be exposed and less likely to be resented. There are fewer activists, fewer muckraking journalists. You don't get a Pulitzer Prize for revealing that CDC is dishonest in a way that you might well get a Pulitzer Prize for revealing that Exxon is dishonest. But it's also true that public is more accepting of good guy dishonesty than of bad guy dishonesty. The sense that you are altruistic not only leads you to think you're entitled to cut corners, it also leads the public to think you're entitled to cut corners. So they cut you more slack. The result of that, I think, is that good guys get into bad habits. In the course of 40 plus years of consulting, I could often convince multinational corporation CEOs that their dishonesty was damaging their profitability. I could actually, and I'm not an ethicist, I wasn't saying stop being dishonest because it's dishonest. I was saying stop being dishonest because it's hurting your business. And I could often convince them to become more honest in order to achieve their goals more. I would say the same thing to public health clients. If you're more honest, the public will be more accepting of your goals. And they tended not to believe me. And for the most part, they were right. Their dishonesty in the short term was saving lives. And the long term hadn't happened yet. They were getting away with their dishonesty. Nobody was exposing it. And on those rare occasions when it was exposed, the public cut them slack and didn't respond negatively. I should mention at least briefly that this is not just true of public health. It is true of public interest organizations of all kinds. It's certainly true of environmental activist groups that persuading environmental activist groups to tell the truth was tough for me. It was a tough call because they would argue and argue with some truth that their dishonesty was not boomeranging against them in the way that corporate dishonesty routinely does boomerang against corporations. So over the long haul, next slide, please. And I don't have to read this out loud to you, but some of you, you can read it while I talk, but it basically says what I've just been saying. For decades, I told my public health clients that someday you're going to reap the whirlwind as a result of your continuing dishonesty. Your prioritization of health over truth, your willingness to suppress truthful information in the interest of getting people to take the right precautions. And I almost always lost. And the reason I almost lost is because I had very few examples where public health officials were, one, caught in their lies, and two, the public reacted with outrage and diminished trust, and three, the result was actually harmful. Not just to the agencies, but to actual public health, to the goals of the agencies. My case that Noble Lives were backfiring was weak. Their case that Noble Lives noble lives, we're saving lives, we're stronger. And so that, you know, the public health agencies routinely told me that, you know, that was in theory, I might be right. But in practice, dishonesty was, the best policy. And they were right until they were wrong. And they were wrong, it seemed to me, only or mostly when COVID, came on the scene. And that's when, in the United States, public trust in public health, genuinely collapsed, especially on the political right. Next slide, please. Now, this is all more complicated than I can afford to, address coherently in a single hour. So I have slides here that cover material I'm not going to cover, about some of the complexities of public health dishonesty, some of the issues and deciding how bad it is. You know, how false is the dishonesty? How big is the dishonesty? Are you being dishonest about details or about big picture falsehoods? How intentional is the dishonesty? And that one I am going to talk about for a minute. How pro-social are your motives? Is this actually a noble lie? Are you lying to save lives, or are you lying, you know, to protect your reputation? Are you lying for ego reasons or ideological reasons? You know, so all of that matters. But I want to talk about intentionality for a minute, because I think the reality is that for the most part, most of the time, my public health clients are in a middle range. Between sort of mustache twirling, full on deception, and ignorant, you know, innocent ignorance, honest mistakes. And the essence of that middle range is, you know, when I accuse a public health client, and this goes all the way back, my first public health client where honesty was the issue was working on HIV in the 1980s. And you know, the pattern, the normal pattern is, you know, I say, look, you know, you're saying things that aren't true. And they would, the client would say, no, I'm not, you know, I'm not dishonest. I'm not doing that. And then I would, you know, sympathetically cross-examine them. I would catechize them, if you will, providing chapter and verse. Well, here's what you said. Is that compatible with the data? And I would get them very reluctantly, because I'm not the enemy. I'm their consultant. They're paying me money to go through this. And I would get them very reluctantly to say, all right, well, yeah, you're right. That's really not true. You know, but they still don't feel like they're lying, because their motives are pro-social, and maybe because they're not thinking about the facts that they're distorting. They're not focusing on them. It's only when they're talking to me that they can, you know, briefly focus on, yeah, you're right, that's dishonest. And as soon as I leave, they would click right back into thinking that they're being honest, or at least feeling honest. And that's the pattern. It's hard to describe and it's hard to understand, but I think it's very important to understand, because, you know, public health people, and this is an audience of mostly public health people, public health people do not feel dishonest, even though nearly all of you, and there are 174 of you at the moment, nearly all of you, I could sit down with you over a beer and show you concrete examples where you said something you knew perfectly well wasn't true. But you don't feel dishonest because your motives are good and because you're not focusing on the facts you're hiding or the facts you're distorting. You're focusing on the pieces of truth that you choose to focus on in order to sell the public health behaviors or public health attitudes that you're trying to sell. Next slide, please. This is some more of the complexities that I'm not going to talk about. How emotionally loaded is the dishonesty? How systemic is it? How consequential is it? How beneficial or harmful to public health is it? How much outrage is it provoking? You know, this is a multidimensional variable, you know, public health dishonesty. And what I'm trying to do is concede that without getting, you know, trapped in an effort to make sense out of all the dimensions at the same time. Next slide, please. So the bottom line here, vis-a-vis the public health leadership, is you're somewhere in the middle range between deception and self-deception. You're hiding pieces of the truth for what you consider to be good reasons. You're not focusing on those pieces so you don't feel dishonest, even though if cross-examined, you would reluctantly admit your dishonesty. And then as soon as the cross-examination ended, you would forget it as soon as possible. It's important to notice that public health followers, individual clinicians, for example, doctors, are not in the same boat. They are typically not being dishonest. They are genuinely saying what the leadership has told them to say without realizing that it's dishonest. And the pattern that my wife Jody Lenard and I have identified over many, many years, is, you know, the leadership will carefully construct a message that's not honest, but is not an outright lie. And they work very hard. It takes five or six drafts to come up with something that's misleading and not actually a lie. And the leadership will usually do that. Okay. And then the followers will find that message too complicated, and they will simplify it in the interest of being clear. And they will turn a misleading, not quite lie that the leadership carefully constructed into something that's flat out false. They're not lying. They have been successfully misled, and they've oversimplified something misleading into something that's an actual lie. It's also worth mentioning, and this is not in the slide, that when Jody and I would point out to, say, a state or local public health official that actually the message points that CDC is urging you to focus on are incompatible with the CDC's own data, why don't you actually go with the data instead of going with the message points? We would almost always lose that battle. A specific example very quickly, during the swine flu pandemic, in the run-up to the swine flu pandemic, the ACIP and the CDC guessed wrong about what ages would be most vulnerable. And they developed their vaccine prioritization recommendations based on their wrong guesses about which ages were likely to be most vulnerable. And then the data came out, or, you know, we began to see who was dying and who wasn't dying, and they realized they were wrong. And they totally honorably published the data so that you could go to MMWR and see, oh, look, they got it wrong. Here's who's actually dying. But they didn't publicize that discovery because they didn't want to flip-flop. They didn't want to be accused of flip-flopping. So CDC stuck to the wrong prioritization, even as it published the data that said it was wrong. So Jody and I would go to state health officials and local health officials, and we'd say, look, here's the data. It's the CDC's own data. Look at it. It's very, very clear. You know, you're prioritizing the wrong people for vaccines. And they would say to me, yeah, so see what you're saying, but until CDC changes its recommendations, we're not going to change our policies. So it's not just the followers are misled. The followers, even when they learn they were misled, mostly continue to be led because they do not want to deviate from the mainstream recommendations and the mainstream message points. Okay, next slide, please. This is an in-passing acknowledgement that's really important. Your enemies are worse. And in saying that public health is dishonest, which is not my main message, I am not trying to say that your critics are honest. A higher percentage of what they say are flat-out lies than of what you say. It's also true that a lot of what you think are flat out lies are actually the same kind of sort of half lies that public health deploys, accurate but misleading factoids, cherry picking the data, and so forth. It's also true that, like public health, the opponents of public health lose track of their own dishonesty. Thanks to cognitive dissonance, they come to believe even their flat out lies. They too think their lies are noble. The point here is that, there's no question in my mind, public health is less dishonest than the anti-vaxxer movement. The truth is mostly on your side. So you don't have to lie as much as they do. Okay. But that's what I think. But that's not what they think. They think there are very few, they think you are lying more than they are lying. The point is there are very few mustache twirling liars on either side. And the other point that I think is really important is we always judge opponents on a tougher ethical standard than we judge ourselves. That's normal human nature. So if you are telling lies for what you consider good reasons and they are telling lies for what they consider to be good reasons, you don't think their reasons are good reasons, so you don't think their lies are forgivable, whereas you think your own are. That's exactly how they assess the situation in reverse. Okay, probably enough of that. Let's go to some pre-COVID examples. And then after that, I want to get to some COVID examples. Okay, example number one, oral polio vaccine. As most of you probably know, the OPV was until recently the first choice for developing countries in the polio vaccination, in the polio eradication campaign for good reasons. And it had two main downsides. One is it's a live, both because it's a live vaccine, it can rarely give a vaccinee polio, and somewhat less rarely, it can launch an outbreak that infects unvaccinated people. The first of those is called VAP. The second is called VDPV. And it's worth noting in passing that PDPV is the main reason Americans still get polio shots. There's essentially no natural polio, in the United States. But there are immigrants and visitors whose OPV can be excreted and might otherwise give us polio. So we are getting polio shots here in 2025, not to protect us from natural polio, but to protect us from the polio that results from the oral polio vaccine. Next slide, please. Those are all just truths. But for decades, when OPV was the chosen, was the vaccine of choice, the polio eradication campaign officially, inevitably, routinely hid these facts. VAP and VDPV were written about in MMWR articles and in other journals, but they were not shared with parents or the general public. And when a case became locally visible, it was dismissed as a coincidence. I consulted briefly with the polio eradication campaign, and I recommended telling parents of prospective vaccinees in developing countries about VAP and VDPV. And the reaction was that it would be malpractice to tell parents the truth about VAP and VDPV. It would be malpractice because that honesty would diminish uptake of the vaccine, and the dishonesty was saving lives. And at least in the short term, they were right. Next slide, please. Just to sort of document this, this is an excerpt from a 2011 OPV campaign training manual that was used in multiple countries. Trainees were instructed to memorize the answers word for word. The question, are there side effects from the vaccine? The answer, no, there are no side effects. Experience shows that if children develop diseases or symptoms after vaccination, it is a mere coincidence. They would have developed these diseases anyway, with or without vaccination. As of when I was putting together these slides, that was still available on the internet. So you can go read that training manual to your own satisfaction. Even David Heyman, a name that some of you may know and a genuine public health hero, used the coincidence excuse in a VAP controversy in Indonesia. And he did what public health leaders try to do. He said something along the lines of, this could happen by coincidence, which is, of course, true. What he didn't say is that he knew damn well that in the case he was talking about, it didn't happen because of coincidence. It happened because of VAP. So again, you have a leader misleading without quite lying. That's what leaders try to do when possible. Okay, next slide, please. That's all I'm going to say about polio. The second slide brings things closer to home. Measles. And here's the widespread, carefully nurtured misimpression. U.S. measles incidence has dangerously increased because MMR vaccine uptake has declined. Children whose parents don't make sure they get both MMR shots on the recommended schedule are facing a grave risk and imposing a grave risk on their classmates and neighbors. That is the core message of public health about measles. Next slide, please. Now, here are some inconvenient truths. U.S. measles incidence over recent decades show no detectable trend line. Maybe we're going to have one now as a result of the 2025 outbreak in West Texas. That may be the start of a trend line or not. It'll take a few years to know. But you look at the last 20 years or the last 30 years or whatever range you want to look at, and there's no trend line. There are bad years when there's a lot of travel from countries with big outbreaks to pockets of low vaccine uptake. There are good years when there's not so much travel from those kind of countries to those kinds of pockets. It's also worth noting that the second MMR is recommended just before kindergarten as a logistical convenience. Medically, you could have the second shot a month after the first shot. It seems to me if officials were as worried about measles as they say they are, and perhaps even think they are, they would recommend the second shot a month after the first shot. It's also worth noting that the second shot increases VE from 93% to 97%. It's not a booster. It's responding to the small percentage of the population whose first shot didn't take. If the measles vaccine weren't part of a combo shot, worried parents could check their kids' titers and most kids wouldn't need the second dose at all. Nobody needs the second rubella dose. You only get a second rubella dose because it's in the combo shot. I think it's worth saying that, I mean, obviously 2025 is the worst measles year in a couple of decades. There have been three deaths already. And maybe measles is roaring back. I don't think so. The predictions, the modeling predictions that say if we keep going the way we're going, pretty soon measles will be endemic again in the U.S. I think that's probably true if we keep going the way we're going, but we don't keep going the way we're going. Vaccine uptake is responsive to disease patterns. My very strong sense is as long as access to the MMR isn't threatened, outbreaks are self-limiting. The bigger the outbreak and the deadlier the outbreak and the more publicized the outbreak, the more parents are likely to say to themselves, gee, you know, I didn't think this vaccine was terribly needed and I didn't want to take the risk, but now I want to take the risk, because, a neighbor died. I think the idea that measles could come roaring back in a country where the MMR is readily available is probably false to start with. Next slide, please. I want to sort of skip to a thought experiment at the bottom of this slide. Most vaccine hesitancy is, or at least much of it, is fear about an MMR autism connection. I think that fear is unjustified. As far as I know, there's been a lot of research. There is no such connection. But what's interesting is it's about the MMR. And fear about monovalent measles vaccination would probably be much lower, because Wakefield didn't study whether a monovalent measles vaccine gives you autism or didn't claim to study or pretend to study. So here's my thought experiment, two thought experiments. First thought experiment, would more West Texas vaccine hesitant parents agree to vaccinate their kids against measles in the middle of an outbreak if they could pick a monovalent measles vaccine? If you said to them, okay, you don't want vaccines against diseases that aren't circulating, but this is a disease that is circulating. It's in your neighborhood. It's in your town. Get at least the vaccine against the thing that's circulating. You don't worry about mumps. Don't worry about rubella. At least do it for measles. The first thought experiment is, would more parents say yes? The second thought experiment is, assume that they would. Would the public health mainstream want to offer a monovalent measles vaccine? And I don't know the answer to that. We could find it out with a couple of focus groups, but my intuition is that maybe they wouldn't. The question is, which is higher priority to the public health mainstream, stemming the West Texas outbreak or standing tall for the safety of the MMR? If you want to stand tall for the safety of the MMR, you don't want to give in to people who wrongly think the MMR is dangerous. If you want to stop the outbreak, maybe you want to offer them a monovalent vaccine. That's a thought experiment for those of you who are in public health, just to wonder whether you and your colleagues or the people you work for would, if they had data that it helps, would they be willing to offer people a monovalent measles vaccine in the middle of a measles outbreak? Next slide, please. As I've already said, measles really could come roaring back if many more parents stopped vaccinating their children and if they didn't restart vaccinating their children when the outbreak started. But I think it's dishonest to claim or imply that this has happened already, knowing that except for low vaccination pockets, it hasn't happened already. And to tell that lie in order to help keep it from happening, I think is dishonest. I noticed in passing there have been a lot of comments, but somebody commented that the monovalent vaccine is not available in the U.S., and that's true. But if public health wanted it to be available, then I assume manufacturers could be persuaded to make it available. So that, it's not available because the public health establishment has decided that giving parents a choice is medically unwise. That you'll get more uptake of all three vaccines if you put them in the same shot. And that's not crazy, but it has a cost for parents who are afraid of the MMR and also afraid of the measles outbreak in their community and would compromise with the measles vaccine if they could get one. Next slide, please. Last slide on measles. Just a couple of examples of routine measles exaggeration. Public health often says 1 to 3 in 1,000 infected people will die. That may be true in developing countries, but back before there was a measles vaccine, there were fewer than 500 measles deaths a year, even though the entire age cohort, about 4 million people, caught measles every year. As best I can tell, an accurate number in a country with good nutrition, good sanitation, and good health care would be 1 in 10,000. And even as I say that, obviously, there have been 3 measles deaths in the U.S. already this year. So that, I mean, that if I'm right about 1 in 10,000, the 3 deaths are statistically unlikely. And I have no explanation for that. But, you know, if you look at the numbers prior to this year, 1 in 10,000 looks a lot more accurate than 1 to 3 in 1,000. Another piece of exaggeration, even casual contact will infect 90% of seronaive people. And of course, as you all know, in measles outbreaks, officials routinely monitor unvaccinated contacts. Most of those unvaccinated contacts don't end up with measles. So the claim that 90% of them will end up with measles is disproved in virtually every outbreak. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to skip that one.
You asked me to tell you when 45 minutes was up. So this is, we're about at 45 minutes.
Oh boy. Okay. Going to skip both examples are vaccine related. I just want to mention without going into it, because I'm misusing my time here. E-cigarettes are a non-vaccine example. And they're also my best example of public health lies that are not noble lies. The claim, the widespread claim that e-cigarettes are as dangerous as smoking in the United States, which is, I think, palpably false, is killing people, is persuading significant numbers of smokers that smoking is less dangerous than vaping, and they will continue to smoke. If only Bloomberg had bought Juul and marketed e-cigs as a harm reduction tool, we would be in better shape. But in the interest of time, I will not say more about e-cigs. Next slide. Some examples I didn't pick. I won't go into those. Next slide. Finally, COVID dishonesty. A lot of public health COVID dishonesty, I have to concede, was not dishonesty about what they believed or at least what they hoped. It was dishonesty about how sure they were that herd immunity is achievable, that vaccines stop transmission, that school closures are essential, and so forth. And I think this is super important. Of course, public health got things wrong. It was a novel pathogen. That's not the point. The point is that they so seldom admitted to the public that they might be wrong. And I should add that when they discovered they were wrong, public health was very slow, typically, to concede the point. So the pattern, the normal pattern is you take what you hope is going to be true and you think might well be true, and you know if it's true, if people believe it's true, it'll help facilitate their taking the precautions you want them to take. So you confidently claim it's true, knowing but not thinking about the fact that you're really not sure it's true. Okay. And then if it turns out true, fine, you guessed right. If it turns out untrue, you're very reluctant to admit it, partly because you don't want to admit that you lied, partly because you don't want to look like you're flip-flopping, and partly because you don't want people to know it, because you want them to think the things that will get them to take the behaviors that are most likely to protect them. So your motives are good. But what's happening and what happened with COVID dishonesty most frequently is a hopeful optimism turned into overconfident assurances, which became dishonest when the evidence got clearer and clearer that they were wrong. So a few examples of that more quickly than I wish I didn't have such a time problem. Number one, masks. I think public health went from masks don't work, which Fauci pretty much conceded in an interview that the reason he said masks don't work when he thought they do work is because there was a shortage of surgical masks and N95s, and he wanted them saved for doctors. But you know, what he said is, you have no use for a mask. And then later on, he and public health in general went to the other extreme and said that, you know, it's urgently important to wear a mask, even outdoors, even alone. You just got to wear a mask all the time. And interestingly, both when public health was saying masks don't work and when public health was saying masks are essential, public health was not discriminating the kinds of masks. So it went from even N95s don't work was the implication to even crappy masks work fine was the implication. Next slide, please. There were all kinds of rationales for pretending that all masks are equally protective. It was scarcity, then it was message simplicity, it was comfort, it was equity, it was, you know, it was all kinds of things. But the bottom line is, by early 22, as N95s became more available, public health agencies did belatedly start acknowledging the differences among different kinds of masks. It was, in my judgment, largely too late. Some people learn to mistrust public health, and that's, you know, the core of my message today. Other people learned to trust. I wrote here mistrust, but I said it wrong. Other people learned to trust crappy masks. And you know, that's the price we paid. Next slide, please. Another and more complicated example is lab leak. And I want to be perfectly clear, I have no knowledge about whether COVID originated in a Wuhan lab or whether it originated through natural spillover in an animal market. I don't know that. What I know is that the people who claimed very early in the pandemic to be certain or nearly certain that COVID originated in an animal market were lying about their certainty. I can't say they were lying about where it originated because I don't know where it originated, and they didn't either. But the claim that COVID, you know, the claim that it was a conspiracy theory to say COVID might have originated in a lab, that claim was dishonest. Some of you know the history, and I urge all of you to learn the history of the NIH leadership and the world leadership on Slack conversations worrying about the fact that it might be might have originated in a lab. And then deciding to reassure the public in the famous Proximal Origins article that it did not originate in a lab and that anybody who claims it did is a fool or a knave. You know, that this is a dishonest, clearly false conspiracy theory. Another dishonest claim, it seems to me, was the claim to be assessing the data objectively. As if the scientific establishment didn't have a very clear stake in COVID not having originated in the lab. And yeah, I think, again, I wish I had time to talk about this more. I think a part of the evidence that that this is not about science is the very strong correlation between whether you approved of gain-of-function research before COVID and whether you thought COVID originated in the lab. Virtually everybody who was anti-gain-of-function research comes out confident that lab leak was responsible for COVID. Virtually everybody who supported gain of function research comes out confident that that COVID resulted from natural spillover. That makes no sense at all. I mean, there should be a zero correlation between what you thought about gain of function research before COVID and what you think happened that launched COVID. That they should be completely uncorrelated. They are very strongly correlated, which tells us that neither side is doing science in making its claim. Next slide, please. I need to concede that, you know, long after the public health establishment was dishonestly claiming to be confident that COVID resulted from natural spillover. Better epidemiological data materialized that very strongly suggested that they were right. Now, you can decide whether you trust those data. The data came from China. The data came from Chinese experts who had every reason not to want it to have been their lab. The data came very belatedly. And it's lots of reasons to say I don't trust those data. But I think I have to concede that if you trust those data, the matter is now pretty well settled, and it didn't start in a lab. It started in the animal market. If you trust those data, it's important to remember the people who are telling us to trust those data were confident it started in an animal market before they had any of those data. So their confidence was not grounded in the data. It was grounded in a desire to convince us that their profession was not responsible for the worst pandemic in 100 years. Okay, next slide, please.
I'll just give you a 5-minute note.
Okay, 5 minutes before I'm done or 5 minutes before we ought to go to Q&A?
Well, some people are going to leave at the time at the hour, so 5 minutes before we're done. But some people can stay. There is a session after this where people can stay on.
Okay. Well, I hope everybody will stay, but I will use the 5 minutes to say some more things. Third example is aerosols. This picture is a WHO website. Fact check: COVID-19 is not airborne, and WHO continued to insist that for quite a long time. As most of you know, it mattered to what percent, to what extent COVID was transmitted by the three ways the transmission was possible: fomites, droplets, and aerosols. To the extent that it was fomites, sanitizing and washing was key. To the extent that it was droplets, social distancing and cloth masks would be useful. To the extent that it was aerosols, probably sanitizing and washing and social distancing and cloth masks, none of those were going to help very much against aerosols. If it was aerosols, you needed ventilation and N95 respirators. So that question mattered. They didn't know the answer until they did know the answer. But long before they knew, they rebutted the aerosol hypothesis in order to reassure the public and sell social distancing and masks. Next slide, please. Skipping down to the end of this, aerosol transmission continued to be downplayed long after the data were clear. They didn't want to frighten people. They didn't want to discourage precautions that were easy and inexpensive, albeit not very useful, but mostly because they didn't want to acknowledge their early overconfident mistake. Okay, next slide. I could do an hour on just this one. The safety of the COVID vaccine and the efficacy of the COVID vaccine. And I want to be clear, the COVID vaccine is a miracle. It has saved millions of lives. And it's as clear as that is to me, it is equally clear to me that mainstream public health has consistently been dishonest about vaccine safety and vaccine efficacy. The question is, to what extent is getting people to get this life-saving vaccine a good enough reason to tell a noble lie? And that's partly an ethical question, of course, but it's also a strategic question, because when you tell lies, you might get caught. People might smell a rat, and then the dishonesty backfires. Among the things I could say, and I'm going to do this very quickly. The emergency use authorization process, by definition, almost is less protective than full licensure. That's why we have a different process. So the claim that no corners were cut was crazy. It looked like the EUA process that FDA had outlined would reach fruition early enough to permit a vaccine rollout before the 2020 election, at least partly to deny Trump an October triumph. At the last minute, FDA added new hurdles for the manufacturers to jump so that the rollout didn't come until after the election. The pre-rollout trials were not powered to measure impact on fatalities, but public health claimed that the trials proved that the vaccines were 100% effective at preventing deaths. By that measure, the placebo worked almost as well at protecting deaths. There were very few deaths in either the placebo groups or the vaccine groups. Next slide, please. A whole lot of things. As you know, as it became clear that children were least endangered, we continued to stress pediatric COVID vaccination far more than in other countries. As it became clear that vaccination was less protective than prior infection, we continued to deny the efficacy of natural immunity. As it became clear that vaccination did not prevent transmission, we continued to claim that it could stop the spread, that it was a sterilizing vaccine even after Provincetown proved it wasn't. Next slide. As it became clear that the vaccine efficacy waned quickly, we continued to claim that the vaccines were long lasting, and so on. I won't read all of these bullet points. You can look at them at your leisure. I do want to stress the one about mandates, as it became clear that resentment of mandates was undermining acceptance of the vaccine themselves. Public health continued to support mandates and conflate opposition to mandates with being anti-vax. One of the things that everybody in social science knows is that coercion leads to outrage. That phenomenon is known in the social science literature as reactance. When you coerce people, they become more disapproving of the thing you are making them do. Every social scientist knows that. Every parent knows that. But public health ignored it or didn't know it, and continued to think that if vaccination is a good idea, which it was, then mandating vaccination must also be a good idea, which was a much more problematic assumption. And it seems to me that the mandates did humongous damage to public health in vaccine, not, you know, to public trust, not just in COVID vaccination, not just in vaccination, but in fact in public health itself.
Peter,
next slide.
With that, I think we should sort of pause here for a moment. And for the folks who have to go at the 1 o'clock hour, I want to say thanks so much for joining. You know, Peter's work often challenges my viewpoints and my assumptions. And so I really appreciate this opportunity to sort of think outside of our public health bubble. And sometimes this kind of felt like, I know many of you know that I was an Olympic swimmer, and sometimes this kind of felt like I had a bad swim and now I got to go talk to my coach, and he's going to tell me a lot of things that I don't really like to hear. You know, I think that, you know, it's a good opportunity for us to think critically about, you know, some of the ways that we can do better next time. So for those of you who can only stay on for the 1 o'clock hour, really appreciate you being here. And for those of you who want to hang on longer, Peter will be able to be here for the next hour, I believe, so we can have some conversation and discussion at that point.
Tara, let me, before people leave, let me say for those who are still here, the three things I didn't get to. One is, why is the resulting distrust mostly on the political right? And there are slides on that. One is how to earn back trust. And there are slides on that. And then at the very end, I have two slides with about 30 links to other things I have written about public health dishonesty. My understanding is that Johns Hopkins is going to distribute the slides to everybody who was on this grand rounds. So if you know, you can look back over the things that I slid through too quickly, and you can also access the things I never got to. And with that, I'll say thank you to the people who have to leave. And Tara, you will honcho the Q&A for us. And I'm here as long as anybody wants to stay.